Deborah Thompson lost her husband to a heroin overdose. He left behind a strong marriage and his one-year-old son. He didn't think it could happen to him. No one did. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, Deborah Thompson is a policy advisor and legislative liaison for the Department of Public Health. She recently decided to speak out about her husband's struggle with opioid addiction, a struggle that ultimately cost him his life. I'll talk with her and Dr. Anthony Miller, director of addictive disorder services at the VA in Iowa City, will be here. We'll talk about treating this powerful addiction. We'd also like to hear from you. Please share your experiences and your questions this hour. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are in the middle of an opioid addiction epidemic in this country. It seems to have started in southern Ohio, and it's moving west. Experts expect the crisis to peak in Iowa in about 3 years, but already people here are dying. Families are being torn apart. Law enforcement and medical professionals are overwhelmed. As policymakers try to respond, one of the people they depend on for information is Deborah Thompson. She's a policy advisor and legislative liaison for the Department of Public Health. She recently decided to share her personal experience with a six-member committee of senators and representatives. She shared her story on the day that would have been her seventh wedding anniversary, a little more than a year after she lost her husband to an accidental heroin overdose. And she's agreed to share her story with us today. Deborah, hello.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here and for sharing your story. Why did you decide it was important to tell people what happened to you and your family?
Well, as you mentioned, I am typically the person who's giving dispassionate facts and figures to legislators. And even over the course of a year since I lost Joe, I believe that everyone has a level of understanding. Everyone's on script because we've been privy to a lot of information at conferences and so forth. But I think that to really have a deeper understanding, I thought it was important to give them a face, someone they know, someone they trust, and someone they, I think, respect, so that as they are approaching these tough policy decisions, that just may help. And this would hopefully be the only time that I'd be able to offer them something a little deeper than facts and figures.
It took a lot of courage to tell that story, and I really appreciate you being willing to tell us again today. But let's go back in time to when this addiction started. It started in 2004. Tell me what happened.
Joe was in a serious car accident. He was turning left on Highway 6569 in Indianola, and this was before they had a stoplight there, and someone came going, I think, 45 miles an hour and rear-ended him. And the doctor had told us that had he not been such a large man, Joe was 6'6 and well over 200 pounds, he probably would have lost his life then. But the thickness of his neck and his size, thankfully, saved him.
So he obviously was injured and mm-hmm. in a lot of pain, and
right.
that's where this addiction began. Tell me what the treatment was.
Well, the doctor had a philosophy of treating Joe's pain with a fire hose instead of a garden hose. So he was prescribed quite a bit of painkillers for an extended period of time.
And
then physical therapy was okay. also part of the treatment as well.
And after that extended period of time, after the prescriptions ran out, what happened then?
Well, he began to doctor shop, and he also had access to prescription drugs through his job as a package handler for UPS. And so there he benefited from the unregulated pill mills in Florida who were sending prescription drugs all over the country. He figured out a name and a location to look for on the boxes and then figured out how to smuggle the prescription drugs out of the facility. So he was on legal drugs, prescription drugs, for at least 5 years unchecked.
When did you find out about this addiction? Because he worked very hard to hide it.
He did. Joe was an incredibly intelligent person and was very much able to manipulate and keep family members apart so that he could continue the addiction. He was under the influence of this disease. I found out there were discrepancies in my bank account. And when I was confronting him about it, he finally blurted out and admitted that he was addicted to opioids and that he had a problem with it. And that's why money was disappearing.
So once you found out about the addiction, and then you were in this together, you had the opportunity to at least try to help him. And I know you tried so hard to help him. What did you do then?
I was stunned. I was taken aback. It was during the busiest time of my year annually, which is session. I was angry. You call it an opportunity to help. I'm not sure I took advantage of the opportunity. I think I spent more time being angry with him and not understanding his what was going on with his brain. And I think that's one of the regrets that I have that I hope people learn from our story is that right away we should have got him into treatment. So he actually ended up weaning himself off of the prescription drugs on his own. And in retrospect, we should have immediately had counseling supports put in place. He should have been a part of a program. I should have been a part of a family support service where I could learn more about what was going on with him. And instead, we didn't do any of that.
But he decided he could handle this himself. He weaned himself off the drugs. He went back to school, right? To get a nursing degree. But then he was worried about having access to pills again.
Right. So he always gravitated toward the helping professions. He wanted to be a nurse, as you said. Well, he ended up getting a bachelor's degree, so that would be a bit more flexible than simply getting an RN, which we thought was positive. But at the end, he realized that being this close to opioids would be detrimental. And after going to school for something for 4 years and then realizing that's not going to work out, his anxiety rose exponentially. That coupled with the student loans that were becoming due when he didn't have a job also caused him anxiety because, you know, finances are always an important part of any relationship and there's never enough dollars to go around. So his anxiety just simply grew out of that and he relapsed.
Your mother-in-law was helping out with finances in this very difficult time. And because of that influx of money, of cash that you didn't see, that gave him the ability to start buying drugs.
Right. So he was using money that his parents had given him to pay off his loans, but also to buy, again, mainly prescription drugs and morphine. And then I do believe, I know, he experimented with heroin a few times.
When did he finally seek treatment? Was there a point at which he realized he couldn't do this on his own?
Yes, although, again, he made the unilateral decision. He understood what was going on and that it was not healthy and that there was a lot to lose. And so he actually ended up checking himself into an outpatient program here in Des Moines called United Community Services, UCS. And it had medication-assisted treatment. It had group support, individual therapy. And so this was from December and then January. And then I became concerned about what felt like depression, and I wasn't feeling like I was reaching Joe. And so I reached out to Joe's mom, and we had a conversation where we realized what was going on. And so when we came home to confront him about it, he let us know he was already in treatment, that it was going well enough. And so again, the program didn't have a family support program. So while he was dealing with it as an individual, he was still sort of dealing with it on his own, because there wasn't anything available for Sherry or I to take advantage of in terms of resources.
So how did that affect you?
It was frustrating. The disease presents itself as very selfish. And you know, this person is victimizing you. They're suffering, but you are also suffering in conjunction with their disease, because money is going, leaving. You don't know where it's going. You are paranoid that this person is lying to you because they've done it in the past. And so the fact that all of the treatment was for him only as an individual was frustrating for me, because I felt I needed help as well. And so instead of researching other ways for me to get help, I just continued to be mad at him and mad at the disease. And so we weren't dealing with it as a couple. We were dealing with it as two individuals that weren't reconciling the differences of our perspectives.
What kind of treatment was he getting?
He was getting outpatient therapy. So he would visit a clinic several times a week. He didn't stay overnight anywhere. And he would receive individual counseling from a counselor about once a month. And then he was required to do group sessions several times a week. And then he also was taking Suboxone, which is the medication-assisted therapy. So Suboxone is... he didn't dose at the clinic. He took it home and would cut pieces of a strip as, you know, defined by the doctor. And that medication effectively makes it impossible for someone to experience a high. This is the way I understand it from the prescription drugs. So that's how he was managing for about 2.5 years.
And did this all seem to be working?
It did. It did. The 2.5 years that we spent together when he was in that treatment were positive. We were sort of getting the relationship back on track. He was very present and important to me while I dealt with my mother's illness and subsequent death. He was just my rock. So I couldn't have gotten through that without him. He and I decided to start a family in that time. I really thought that we were done, that we had conquered this, and there would be no going back.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Deborah Thompson. She's a policy advisor and legislative liaison for the Department of Public Health. She has shared her personal story of losing her husband to an accidental heroin overdose to raise awareness about opioid addiction. And we'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me right now is Deborah Thompson. She's a policy advisor and legislative liaison for the Department of Public Health in Iowa. And she recently decided to share her personal experience losing her husband to an opioid addiction. And she shared that story on the day that would have been her 7th wedding anniversary, a little more than a year after she lost her husband. She's sharing her story with us today. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll also bring Dr. Anthony Miller into the conversation. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa and director of addictive disorder services at the VA in Iowa City. And Deborah, before the break, we were talking about a time when it really felt like you and Joe had put this addiction behind you. Things were going well. He had been through a medical or a treatment that included taking Suboxone, which really seemed to minimize the effects of his addiction. It seemed to be a very positive experience for him. There was a shift, though, later on in treatment. Tell me what you decided to do or what Joe decided to do.
So he was transitioning to the final stage of the program, if you will, a recovery stage. And he was winding down the use of the Suboxone, and he had, at the same time, a knee injury that he was getting physical therapy for. And the steroids that were part of that blocked the Suboxone. And so he ended up going into withdrawals, is how I understand that. And so he began what would become his final addiction cycle. And so we got him. Since he was still in UCS, he ended up going back and having to start the program over, and was actually doing well again. But actually, he probably wasn't doing well. I know he wasn't doing well. His anxiety was very high. He ended up overdosing once and then again. And the second time, he overdosed on the Suboxone. And I believe the reason for that was because after the first and initial overdose, he became very anxious. I had found him, and I called the police, and the police found the heroin that he had used. And so with the possibility of a legal battle coming up, he was very, very anxious. Also, and unfortunately, the counselor was at UCS that he had a very close relationship with passed away from a car accident. So Joe was sort of spiraling, a lot of anxiety related to the legal implications, and then also not having his traditional supports around him, like the counselor, I think led him to abuse the Suboxone. And then I found him again. And we thought, well, maybe the Suboxone isn't working after all. And so in retrospect, I regret this decision, but we had opted for an abstinence treatment facility.
And as he was going through that treatment for work, you're learning more about treatment. In fact, you went to a conference on medication-assisted therapy?
Right. And actually, he never actually entered into the abstinence program. So what happened was that we were discussing his enrollment in the program. The facility found out he was still on the Suboxone. I know that timeline gets a little complicated. I apologize. But long story short, they equated Suboxone to heroin. And so required him to be off of Suboxone completely before they would enroll him in the program. And they offered to have him detox, so to speak, at $135 a night, but that was cost prohibited. So he did what he was asked. He called them back after being off the Suboxone for 2 weeks, and they, I guess, had a conversation with him and decided they still didn't want to take him until yet another week. So after that, we decided that we would just break ties with that center and try again. And so, yes, while this was happening, I had attended a training, an MAT training that our staff invited me to, so I could learn more about the grant that we had. And as I was listening to the statistics, something to the effect of MAT users will experience success at twice the rate of abstinence-only programming, I called at a break, and they were also getting into the science of addiction, which includes dopamine levels being out of whack. And so I became concerned that until his dopamine levels were under control, he won't even be able to receive the information in his mind that they were trying to give him. So I was expressing that concern to the folks there, and And I wasn't getting any good answers, which was really concerning. And after they said, after they sort of rejected him, after he spent 2 weeks off of the Suboxone, I called back again and just begged them via voicemail to think of Suboxone as different from heroin, that he was clearly struggling and he needed to get into a program. And they called back and said, you know, I'm sorry, this is just our policies, and we don't want to have him on the Suboxone while he's here. Does that make sense?
I think
it's a little confusing. Sorry.
I'm sure it was confusing to live through.
Oh, it was. I had no idea what choice. There are so many different treatment modalities that it was scary to think we would be making the wrong decision.
And at this time, this was something you dealt with family members, but you hadn't told any of your coworkers that you were dealing with this.
No, I had not.
In that final addiction struggle that started in May and ended in September, during that time, you guys also had a small child.
Yes.
What was it like at home during that time? Because you were the family breadwinner. Mm-hmm. Joe was a stay-at-home dad. Mm-hmm. And the two of you obviously both loved your son very much. That must have been such a struggle for you.
It was. And that's how I know this is not a choice, that this is a disease. We loved Lincoln. We were overjoyed when we had him. I know Joe enjoyed being a stay-at-home dad, and surely for those who are thinking, well, gosh, he had a son, isn't that enough to clean up and quit? Well, arguably, yes, but he wasn't able to. And so that tells you that his brain was not functioning correctly. It was stressful. I was scared to I didn't leave Lincoln at home with Joe by himself, and I think that goes to the level of support that I have from Joe's family, who are all in town here. His parents were very involved. His mother was coming over every day to care for Lincoln while we sought treatment for Joe. It was scary to think that Lincoln would ever see Joe in the kind of shape he was in, because those would be terrible memories for Lincoln and not reflective of who his father really was.
This final struggle, as I said, it really started in May. It ended in September. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, I came home from work, and Joe's mother expressed concern. She had not heard from Joe since he left for treatment. So by this time, we had abandoned the initial facility I described and had checked him into Mercy First Step. And so I jumped in my car and I looked for him there, and I called the counselors. He had signed a release so I could talk to them, and they had not seen him for a few days. And so I think in the back of my head, I had understood what happened, but until you actually see it for yourself, you always have hope. And so for 48 hours, we didn't know where Joe was, which was extremely unlike him. Joe was attached to his phone and had never in his history just disappeared for a couple of days. And so he just would not have wanted us to worry about him. And so finally, I had called AT&T a couple of times, and I finally had a very helpful woman who was able to help me locate Joe, you know, through apps on our phones. And so his mother and I jumped in the car, and we went and found the car and found Joe and called the police, and EMS came and shattered the window and took Joe's pulse, and he didn't make it.
He was dead when they found him.
Yes.
I'm so sorry that you've had to go through this. And again, I just really appreciate your courage in sharing this story with us. You loved Joe very much. You worked very hard on your marriage through everything and tried to help him. He tried to help himself. Mm-hmm. With an addiction, there, you mentioned several times the feelings of anger and frustration with Joe, you also had people telling you that you shouldn't stay with him.
Yes, that did come up. So again, in his final addiction cycle, he overdosed twice, first from heroin and the second time from the Suboxone. And each time the police came, they, you know, they're looking at the scene. They see someone who's clearly on drugs. They see a wife and a small child, and they felt compelled to counsel me on decisions as it related to my marriage and wondered out loud if I needed to make some life-changing decisions. I know they... certainly it was none of their business, but I understood that their heart was in the right place.
If you had left Joe at that point, though, I'm sure it would have felt like you were giving him a death sentence.
Honestly, this will sound strange, but my head was more in the and afraid to lose any time with my son. The idea that I would only see Lincoln even less than 100% of the time was more scary to me than facing Joe's disease. And at that time, I felt like I was finally starting to get the hang of this, that I was I had found a family support program. I was learning about it, and I felt like we could figure this out now. I was committed to Joe. He's all I'd ever known in a relationship, and I took the vows seriously that we made to each other. And I have a respect for people who go through divorce because they must really, really be unhappy in their marriage to only see their children parts of the time.
In this struggle, you had so much knowledge, so much background. You and Joe both had this education and this understanding of what was going on. You have said that at times you feel like you thought you were better than this, that addiction couldn't destroy your family in this way because you had more resources than so many people do.
That's right. It the stigma is deep, Charity. It not only impacts those who are outside looking in, but it impacts people who are in it. For all the reasons you said, we thought we were the right income level, the right education level. Neither one of us had had terrible childhoods. We were ideal, I suppose, doing it right in terms of life. And part of why he was so tired of treatment was that he had to go to this facility. He had to interact with a guard as though they were criminals. He had to talk to people who were, you know, less educated than he was, that he would never necessarily have a beer with at a bar. And I had the same experience. I'll be honest. It's nothing I'm proud of. They told you several times in the family support program and in his group therapy programs that this is an equalizer. Everybody is dealing with the exact same thing. And so you have to be humble about what you're going through. And I just hadn't gotten there yet.
What do you want people to take away from hearing your story? Why is it important to tell and important to hear?
I want people to understand that the stigma is you have to respect it. You have to respect that your perception may be jaded or off for this disease, but that you have to embrace it as you would a family member who is suffering from cancer. Joe's disease wasn't visible. It was... it presented itself in his behavior, not in anything growing on his head or growing out of his ears or anything like that that you could focus on. When my mother had cancer, she had a huge tumor on her brain that we could see on the x-rays. And so when she became volatile, all was forgiven. We understood what was happening. And here there's not that focal point. So when I hear doctors as we talk about different policy approaches in learning from the experience of states like Ohio, they say, well, I know my patients best, and I know as though they can somehow discern who is addicted and who's not. And my I knew my husband best, and I still didn't understand when I was being manipulated. And so I think there's a naivete with the folks who need to be helping in the healthcare professions. I think there's the stigma is deep, again, for outsiders looking in, so societal pressures that people should just act right or make the right choices not to take drugs. And then for the patients themselves and for the family members dealing with it, I think that we have to realize that their family, they will die from this, and their family members will die from this. It will not decide to skip you because you have the right education, the right pedigree.
Losing someone is always difficult. Losing someone to something like this brings with it different challenges. In mourning Joe, has it been hard for you to get past the addiction and your anger?
Well, I would say yes. I think what I've been dealing with in the mourning is more the feelings of guilt. And I see a therapist regularly, too, which I would encourage anyone to do to sort some of these things out in a neutral third party. But I've been just trying to remember that I did the best I could with the information that I had, that I never intended to harm Joe. And now he can help people en masse like he always wanted to through me in helping people not make the same mistakes that we did.
Deborah Thompson, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
I wish you and Lincoln all the best moving forward. Deborah Thompson lost her husband, Joe, to an accidental heroin overdose. She's a policy advisor and legislative liaison for the Department of Public Health. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Dr. Anthony Miller. He is the director of the Addictive Disorder Services at VA in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we've been listening to a devastating personal story about opioid addiction and loss. And now joining us is Dr. Anthony Miller. He is clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa. He's also the director of addictive disorder services at the VA in Iowa City. Dr. Miller, thank you so much for being here today.
Hi.
And listening to Deborah's story, I saw you shaking or nodding your head many times. As devastating as this story is, it's one that's very similar to many that you've encountered.
It's tragically common.
Help us understand this addiction a little bit more. I mean, I think we have, as a culture, an understanding of what addiction is. What sets opioid addiction apart from some of the other addictions that are still so devastating and difficult, like alcohol addiction? What do opioids do to our brains?
Well, one of the ways that opioid addiction is different than some of the other substances that people get addictive to is that they are such useful medications. And one of the effects that they have is they're very good at treating acute pain, at least in the short run. And so unlike, say, cocaine that people are primarily getting involved with in illegal ways, most people's first experience with opioids is being prescribed them by a doctor. And over the course of the last 20 years, we've been much more generous with using opioids in the treatment of pain than we've ever been before. And that has been something of an experiment that has had some unintended consequences. In addition to treating pain, opioids have a lot of other effects in the brain. And one of the things that Deborah mentioned was the effect on dopamine. Dopamine is the brain chemical that tells us that something's important to do. Things that naturally increase dopamine in the brain include things like eating or drinking when we're thirsty, or nurturing our children, or as a child receiving nurture from a parent, or having sexual intercourse. All of those things normally increase dopamine. And it tells us that what we're doing is important and that we need to do that thing again. Or if we encounter those important things, nurture and food and water in a new environment, it helps us remember where we found those things so we can get them again. All of the drugs that people abuse and get addicted to increase dopamine in ways that are in excess of the natural rewards that, dopamine tells us about. So that the person who's using opioids comes to perceive them as more important than eating or drinking or, you know, unfortunately, nurturing their young. Another aspect of opioids that makes them particularly challenging is the fact that when a person's been taking opioids over a period of time, the brain adapts to the presence of, the opioid by a process that we call downregulation. So what happens then is that it takes more opioid to have the same effect. And when the person doesn't have the opioid, they no longer feel normal without it. So they have withdrawal symptoms, which are essentially all of the opposite effects of what taking an opioid does.
So where the opioid makes you feel good, not having the opioid, it can be, you can't feel normal. You can't reach that level of stasis.
Exactly. And so people who are in opioid withdrawal are some of the most miserable people that you'll ever meet. Desperate, really.
Right. With opioids, obviously, they can be incredible for treating pain. Why can some people be weaned off this medication and others can't?
And that's a really good question that I don't think has a simple answer. Some of it's genetics. We know that the risk of becoming addicted to drugs is partly mediated by our genes. It may be that we inherit a different response. You know, one person's response to opioid is somewhat different than others, and that inherited difference might make some people more vulnerable than others. Deborah talked about the fact that Joe had had a good upbringing and that there wasn't sort of a hint in an unhappy childhood or that sort of thing. But we do know that children who experience adverse events in childhood are more likely to become addicted to opioids and other drugs. People who are under unusual stresses or who have problems with other mental illness like anxiety and depression also might be more vulnerable.
With Deborah, she was talking about the different kinds of addiction treatment that Joe went through. And what we're learning, obviously, we're in the midst of this opioid epidemic and people are desperate for answers. So what do we know about treating opioid addiction? What have we learned about what works?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. What we've known actually for close to 50 years now is that the most effective single treatment that exists for treating opioid addiction is methadone maintenance. So methadone is an opioid. It's a very slow and long-acting opioid. And the idea is to hit that sweet spot where the person isn't experiencing any withdrawal, but they're also not experiencing intoxication or getting high. And because methadone is such a long-acting medication, it can be given once a day and keep that person in that level where they're functioning and neither sick nor intoxicated. But methadone has problems. People can overdose on methadone. It can be abused. If you take enough of it, you can get high. So to prevent some of those potential consequences, to use methadone as a treatment for addiction, it has to be in a tightly controlled environment like a methadone clinic. In fact, legally restricted to specialized clinics in the United States.
So that restricts your movement. It also, it's a life sentence. It's something that you need to do every day, forever?
Yeah, how long to treat is another really good question, and there's not a good answer other than that we know that when people who have been successfully treated with methadone maintenance come off of treatment, their risk of relapsing and going back to opioid use goes up significantly. Now, the longer they've been stable in treatment and abstaining from other opioids, the more likely they are to be ultimately successful without the medication. But just the same, the day after they stop taking methadone, they're at higher risk than they were the day before.
Deborah talked about the stigma of addiction, and we know that there's so much shame and so much stigma involved in addiction and dealing with this disease. It's something, you know, Deborah was talking about not telling anyone in her life outside of her family about this. She carried this. Joe carried this on their own. The stigma of addiction treatment is also powerful. I mean, to be on methadone, to go to a methadone clinic on a daily basis, to take this dose of methadone, I mean, there's a lot of stigma involved in that kind of treatment as well, isn't there?
There absolutely is. And some of that makes a lot of sense. When you put together in one place a lot of people who are going through recovery from addiction, you've got people who are unhappy and irritable and sick, and a lot of times that's an unpleasant place to be. Crime happens around methadone clinics. People get into altercations. There are reasons to be concerned about it. And it's a byproduct of putting together people who are unstable in their addiction. One of the biggest breakthroughs in recent years was the introduction of another medication, which Deborah talked about, Suboxone, which is a name brand for buprenorphine. So buprenorphine works similarly to methadone in that it meets that need, meets that opioid debt that people with addiction have, but it has what we would call a ceiling effect. It turns on the opioid system, but only to a point, so that people who have tolerance to opioids or are addicted to opioids usually cannot get to a point of intoxication. They're much less likely to overdose on it than with methadone. That creates the ability for us to prescribe it in outpatient practice and not have to go to a clinic. So you go to your regular doctor and you get a prescription for the medication and you can take it home, and there's less of that stigma that would be associated with going to a clinic. The problem is that also does require that the prescriber have specialized training and certification, and accessing prescribers who have that training is a problem for getting access to the treatment. Deborah also talked about the counseling that Joe was involved with, and certainly medication by itself is no cure-all. And we know that people who get counseling or psychotherapy along with the medication do better than people who don't. But we also know that people who are in the so-called abstinence-only treatments, where they're only getting therapy and not getting medication to correct the physical abnormality in the brain, are at very high risk of dropping out of treatment.
Connect the dots for me, too, between these prescription opioids and heroin, because I'm sure, that, you know, Joe never thought that he would ever buy heroin on the street. I'm sure no one ever thought he would. Making that leap from this pill that was given to you or prescribed to you in a doctor's office in a completely appropriate or seemingly appropriate way to street drugs seems like a big leap.
Absolutely. So heroin is an opioid. It's chemically derived from morphine, which is a common prescription opioid. It was originally developed as a painkiller and was prescribed for that purpose at one time. It became illegal because it was shown to have extremely high abuse and addiction potential. Heroin is essentially a way to get morphine into the brain really fast. It gets there very quickly. That's very reinforcing, very rewarding, and it also wears off fairly quickly. So if the person doesn't continue to feed the habit of using heroin every few hours, they go back into withdrawal. So because it's very because it has such a very high liability for addiction, heroin was made illegal. But it is an opioid. It has all of the same effects as other opioids like morphine or oxycodone or hydrocodone. So when a person doesn't have access to one opioid, they can manage their withdrawal or their debt to opioids by substituting another one. And what I've seen, unfortunately, is that's been often an economic choice for people, that if they're buying illicit prescription opioids, that they're paying more than they would be paying for using heroin. Kind of a rule of thumb that I've heard from people is that when they go from using opioid pills to heroin, they're cutting their cost by about half. And when they go from snorting or smoking heroin to injecting heroin, they're cutting their costs again by another half because it's about twice as potent if they inject it. And so people who started out with something that they thought was safe, it was a pill that the doctor gave them, who ultimately lost control of their use of that pill, ended up on heroin because it's a cheaper way to meet that need.
I want to go to the phones. Martha's on the line in Washington County. Hello, Marcia, or Martha.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to share?
I'm a recovering alcoholic addict, and I've been sober for several decades. And the last time I was in treatment was in 1986 in Minnesota, and there was a kid I got to know in treatment who his only – I didn't know anything about this stuff, but his only drug that he did was OxyContin, and I have no idea if, you know, he's still alive or what. But my daughter was going to school with a young woman who had was in recovery from heroin and all that stuff. And because of that, I got a hold of some information, and that's the main thing I want to plug. She ended up relapsing, and I hope she's doing okay now. We got her into treatment. But what I want to plug is a PBS documentary called Chasing Heroin, and it was put out in – it was shown in February of 2016, and the Coralville Library has a copy of it because I asked them to get it, and also the Iowa City Library is getting a copy of it, and it really explains the whole evolution of the whole hospice movement and the whole deal with all these drugs becoming more available, and Purdue Pharmaceuticals is primarily who has brought us this problem.
Well, Martha, thank you so much for sharing, and obviously knowledge and understanding can help a great deal. With this problem, a lot of doctors are responding, of course, in trying to prescribe these medications that have proven to be so problematic less. We are seeing a change, I believe, in that. That's what we've seen reported by a number of different media organizations. What do you think needs to change as we face this epidemic? Dr. Miller.
One of the unintended consequences of prescribers being more cautious about using opioids is that there's been a decrease in the supply. And unfortunately, some of the things that have happened is more people have turned to heroin. And we've also seen a new threat that's also come in, which is fentanyl. Fentanyl, potent opioid used in medical settings, but also now being illicitly manufactured and sold, and has been responsible for a huge increase in overdose deaths in this country in the last couple of years. So more rational prescribing is, I think, ultimately a good thing, and I think it is an important part of the picture. But as of right now, it's also having unintended consequences. So the other piece that we need with that is better access to treatment. We need to ensure that people who are looking for treatment can get good quality research-supported, evidence-based treatments with things like methadone or buprenorphine, as well as the psychosocial treatments like the counseling and groups.
And we know that that kind of treatment is difficult. There's a real lack of access to that kind of treatment for a lot of people right now, right?
Unfortunately, there is.
Well, Dr. Anthony Miller, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Dr. Anthony Miller is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa and director of addictive disorder services at the VA in Iowa City. We've been talking about opioid addiction this hour, a very personal look at this terrible, terrible problem that's affecting so many people around the country and around the state. This is Talk of Iowa.